The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
What we really observed on Wednesday is the testing of a lot of different theories. We compared it to throwing spaghetti against the wall. You had efforts to tie in some of these outlandish conspiracy theories, particularly by Devin Nunes and some other familiar figures. You had efforts to, in several cases, kind of justify President Trump's actions, the actions of certain other figures, saying, well, isn't it legitimate to have concerns about corruption? Isn't it legitimate to remove your ambassador? We also had a lot of efforts at distraction, essentially, a big focus on the whistleblower, efforts to get the whistleblower to testify, arguments that Chairman Schiff is obstructing those efforts, refusing to cooperate despite prior commitments.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 16th, 2019. Roger Stone has been convicted on 7 counts by a jury in the District of Columbia, and 3, count them, 1, 2, 3, State Department officials have testified before the House Impeachment Committee this week. There's been a lot going on, and we have quite the gang to chew it all over. It's the whole Lawfare crew at various times over the next hour talking about different aspects of the events of the week. We talked about the Stone verdict. We talked about the impact of the testimony on the Hill and the impact on the State Department of watching its senior officials testify against the president. We talked about what to expect coming next. And we talked about how this impeachment fits in with historic impeachments. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 473, quite a week. So we are joined in the Jungle Studio today by a special guest, which is an earth-moving vehicle, which is outside the Brookings Institution moving large quantities of dirt. And so I think we should all just embrace that and work with it. And so with me is Margaret Taylor, Quinta Jurassic, Susan Hennessy remotely, and the earth-moving vehicle. And we're going to start by talking about Roger Stone. Quinta, get us started. What happened today and what does it mean?
Right. Roger Stone was found guilty today of 7 counts. So that's all counts that the prosecution had charged him with, involving obstruction of justice, giving false statements to members of Congress in his testimony in the investigation about Russian election interference, and witness tampering, basically threatening radio host Randy Credico, and most notably, as far as I'm concerned, Randy Credico's dog. So,
what's the dog's name?
Bianca.
Okay, so it's a big day for Bianca.
It's justice, finally, for Bianca. So the thing about this verdict is that it doesn't go directly to the question of, you know, did the Trump campaign know that WikiLeaks was coordinating with the Russian government, anything like that. It's all about Stone's efforts to kind of stymie the investigation. That said, Stone was a significant figure in Volume 1 of the Mueller report. He sort of put himself forward as the intermediary between the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks, whether he was or not. And honestly, now that he's been convicted, there's one more person in the president's orbit who's been found guilty or has pleaded guilty to federal crimes. So to state the obvious, that's not great if you're Donald Trump.
Susan, is this just a relic of the Mueller era, or does this have some meaningful connection with the other events that are happening this week? I mean, is this a kind of foot stomp on the history of the Mueller investigation that kind of ends a chapter, or is there some more immediate relevance?
So I don't know that it's just a foot stomp to sort of the Mueller story. It's one of the it's certainly the final trial we'll see in which sort of new relevant information is going to come out. And significantly, because this trial is over, a significant portion of material that had previously been redacted in the Mueller report is now presumably going to be revealed. So as Quinta mentioned, part of that information, some of which was referenced in the trial, relates to Donald Trump's advanced knowledge about WikiLeaks releases of damaging of hacked emails designed to damage Hillary Clinton during the election, something that he lied about. Now, those revelations haven't really seemed to break through the media narrative. Certainly this week has still been dominated by impeachment. And it is one of those strange things in which it might have had real impact had it been revealed at the time the Mueller report came out. That said, it was something that most people sort of assumed was already the case. And so it feels a little bit more like confirmation of what a lot of people at least strongly suspected rather than sort of genuine new information. So we'll see, you know, how people might receive that piece of information. The other sort of significant redaction related to Stone that presumably now will be made public as part of the Mueller report is a section that we all assume relates to Roger Stone in the section about the president, President Trump's attempts at obstruction of justice or analysis of episodes that might involve obstruction of justice. So this is an area in which we don't have sort of direct evidence that Roger Stone's name is the one behind those black redaction bars. But we do know that the president at least publicly engaged in behavior that looks a lot like the analysis we saw with respect to Paul Manafort, including sort of tweets praising Roger Stone for not flipping. Of course, in the Manafort section, there was both Trump's public comments and an analysis about whether or not that could constitute obstruction of justice. And then there was also a series of information about private interactions. And so I think one of the big questions is there going to be new information revealed about whether or not Roger Stone actually had some additional interactions with the president that might strengthen the case for obstruction of justice and might strengthen a case in a way that might actually tip the scales to the point that the House of Representatives decides to actually, you know, have some kind of article of impeachment based on the Mueller report, something that they don't seem inclined to do right now. The other thing that I think is significant related to this moment is the big question of pardons. And that is it's thematically related to the extent that Roger Stone kind of went all in with Donald Trump. He, you know, defended him to the very end. And I think the apparent strategy of that was hoping that the president might pardon him. Certainly people who are involved in the current sort of Lafair Ukrainian drama that are going on, people like Rudy Giuliani are likely going to be watching very, very carefully at how that strategy does or does not ultimately pay off. Or Roger Stone, you know, he is facing potentially a very long jail sentence at this point.
All right. So this comes against a background in which the House is hearing live impeachment testimony for the first time from these witnesses who, until this week, had been names on many, many pages. And so this is like the moment where the transcripts come to life and materialize as a, I don't know, night of the living transcripts. Margaret, what is your sense of what the first week of testimony actually conveyed over and above what we already knew from the transcripts?
So I did read all 3,065 pages of the released deposition transcripts.
That makes one of you in Washington.
There actually are a few others. I was asking about it on Twitter, and there were a few others who did that.
Yeah, I think there's a few others who say they did.
Right,
like,
right.
I think the difference between the universe of people who say they did it and who actually did it may be pretty large in percentage terms.
That may be true. From my perspective, there were really only a pretty small number of things that was sort of like new factual information, actually pretty small. So probably the major thing is that Ambassador Bill Taylor testified that an advisor of his brought to his attention last Friday a conversation that this advisor of Bill Taylor's had overheard between Gordon Sondland and President Trump on Gordon Sondland's cell phone, basically. And this person could also hear Trump, and Trump apparently was asking Sondland about the investigations and, you know, really sort of focused on not necessarily the Ukraine corruption or assistance side of Ukraine, but really the focus on these investigations, which is code for investigations into the Bidens and also this sort of conspiracy theory about Ukraine interference in the 2016 election. And so that was a new piece of information. That person's name is David Holmes. He's being deposed today behind closed doors by the committee. And, you know, we'll see if he also testifies in public. So that was really the one sort of bombshell piece of information, I thought, that was new and that came out in these hearings. Other than that, what I would say is it really did bring to life, these hearings have really brought to life what is in the deposition transcripts, which is some pretty damning stuff. And to read it on the page is one thing, but to hear these witnesses talk about it is a different thing, in particular for witnesses that seem very, I'd say, sincere. They're pretty sympathetic. They seem committed to their mission. They seem like committed public servants. So that's seeing that, you know, live in a hearing, I found pretty compelling, actually.
How about you, Quinta? Is, in your judgment, is this from I guess, compelling from a narrative point of view, compelling from a theatrical point of view? Does it advance the ball from an evidentiary point of view? What role, to your mind, are these hearings playing?
So I don't know if it advances the ball from an evidentiary perspective, precisely because the transcripts have all been out there. The exception is the material that Bill Taylor made public, as Margaret said. I think the significance is really that most people did not have the time to read these transcripts. I have not read all, 3,068 pages? Most people haven't even read that. And so there is a value in kind of putting on the show. Not saying that everyone is going to sit down and watch, you know, all 6 or 7 hours of hearings every day for the next week, but it does mean that it's going to show up on television. It's a little more sort of user friendly, and I think there is a power in sort of building the case in the public eye in a way that's easier to digest.
Okay, Susan, I want to posit a very specific evidentiary benefit of these live hearings, which is when you read the transcript, you don't get the opportunity to look the witness in the eye and kind of size up their credibility. It is a dry page. Whereas when you actually see Bill Taylor or George Kent, if you have to get over the bow tie with George Kent, but you know, you have an opportunity to listen to them and say, you know, wow, these are really impressive people. And when you listen to Masha Yovanovitch, you say you can actually experience some of the, you know, shock and pain of this situation for her. And you hear it in the context of a very long and distinguished and professionally and morally serious career. And that is actually a qualitative difference over reading any of these three people in a transcript, as evidenced by the degree to which Republicans are struggling to question them, which was not the case in a deposition setting. What are your thoughts?
I think that's right. Clearly, the witnesses we've seen thus far are you know, very credible, serious people. And I think one thing that's actually a benefit of seeing the hearing and actually having it televised is it's clear that the Republicans actually are taking, accepting their factual representations as accurate. We really don't see Republicans sort of trying to dispute the facts or suggest people are lying or even necessarily suggest people are mistaken. And what they're really trying to do is sort of suggest that there are alternative interpretations here, offering this idea that that somehow maybe Donald Trump really was concerned about corruption, that this is within the power of the president to do, right? And so they really aren't even attempting to suggest that George Kent or Bill Taylor or now Marie Yovanovitch is lying about something. And I think that's really, really significant whenever you think, sort of take a step back and think about what are the facts that these witnesses have put on the table. And they have been quite explicit about what occurred here in terms of essentially this wide-ranging campaign being spearheaded by Rudy Giuliani, and Gordon Sondland to essentially dig up political dirt and political investigations on behalf of the president's private political interests. Now, that's going to become even more significant, I think, as we move into next week and we start to get witnesses who are going to be able to put in, sort of connect the other piece of the puzzle, right? Which is, what was happening on the U.S. side, how personally involved was the president in this, and then of course the pieces related to the hold on military funds. So I do think it's significant. I think these hearings are, despite the fact of sort of the emerging Fox News Republican talking point that this is somehow boring, they are not boring. They are quite riveting, and the format really is working well for the Democrats, in part because by front loading this 45 minutes of questioning for the ranking for the chairman and majority counsel and ranking member and minority counsel, that really lets the most sort of interesting, compelling testimony come up front. So, certainly as we sort of move into hour five and six of members questioning, that is less captivating, that is less informative. But the really, really important stuff is already being done up front. And that's something that I think can grab people's attention span. And the Democrats at an absolute minimum really are using that time to get these witnesses on the record to tell the story about what they witnessed. And I think that story is going to become more dramatic and more damaging than it already is, though it already is quite dramatic and quite damaging, as we have witnesses come forward in the coming weeks who are closer and closer and closer to the president himself.
There's one more point that I would make about the value of having these hearings public and testified that has to do with the way information travels on the internet. Bear with me. I'm going to start with George Kent's bow tie.
Which is actually the center of gravitation in the universe.
Exactly.
It's where we should have started.
So George Kent's bow tie, along with his enormous Nalgene water bottle, kind of became a social media star on Wednesday. There were tweets. There was love. There was mockery. There were multiple news articles written about it in the New York Times, the Washington Post, like Vox, BuzzFeed, you name it. There were also memes about Bill Taylor, the chargé d'affaires in Ukraine, sounding like Walter Cronkite and sort of making funny expressions and that kind of thing. I'm not saying that those memes are the most sophisticated way to communicate what's going on in the impeachment hearings, because obviously they're only a small part of it. But I actually do think it's a good example of how hearings can make this process kind of come alive and engage people. No one was memeing the transcripts. And
I was, Quinta.
Yeah. Well, Margaret was, but maybe no one else. And so the fact of having a visual that you can kind of engage with in the public conversation, I think, is potentially a very powerful thing.
And I would just add that, one person who does seem to be very engaged, at least with the Yovanovitch testimony, is President Trump himself, because he, tweeted during her testimony basically a smear of her, an insult to her, which was then immediately, the chairman immediately asked Yovanovitch about. So it's really something I think unique. We are in impeachment proceedings. The president is live tweeting the impeachment proceedings and creating evidence for impeachment in real time during the hearing, meaning, you know, there could be, in theory, an article of impeachment about basically intimidation of witnesses during these proceedings.
All right. We are joined now by Lawfare senior editor Scott Anderson. Scott, you and Quinta wrote a piece, can't remember when it was, after the first hearing, Wednesday, where you talked a little bit about the Republican, emerging Republican defense. I'm interested in your sense of, now we've had a couple days of this, and there's the lines of questioning do suggest kind of what they're thinking at this point and what the they've sort of struggled to come up with a unitary line of defense. But where do they seem to be headed now?
Sure. I mean, what we really observed on Wednesday is the testing of a lot of different theories. We compared it throwing spaghetti against the wall. You had efforts to tie in some of these outlandish conspiracy theories, particularly by Devin Nunes and some other familiar figures. You had efforts to, in several cases, kind of justify President Trump's actions or the actions of certain other figures, saying, well, isn't it legitimate to have concerns about corruption? Isn't it legitimate to remove your ambassador? We also had a lot of efforts at distraction, essentially, a big focus on the whistleblower, efforts to get the whistleblower to testify, arguments that Chairman Schiff is obstructing those efforts, refusing to cooperate despite prior commitments, and a big focus on other aspects of this proceeding, what Nunes described as a star chamber, basically saying all these people had completed their auditions in the closed door proceedings, arguments that they've somehow obstructed information and withheld it by not releasing transcripts, even though, of course, Republican members of the committee were there during the closed door testimonies. And the latter in particular, you know, all aimed at questions that really don't have much bearing on the legitimacy of the president's conduct, the things that are really central to the impeachment inquiry. And that's why we kind of categorize them as a distraction. In today's testimony with Ambassador Yovanovitch, we see a more of a focus on that central avenue, that question of trying to legitimate the president's behavior. The emphasis has really been on, well, the president has the right to remove ambassadors, right? And Yovanovitch agrees that he does. And then the emphasis has been on, well, Yovanovitch, you didn't really get abused. You were, even though the president said that he kind of intended to do so on the call with Zelensky, instead you landed at Georgetown. You have a fine career. You're going to have a good career ahead of you, which is, you know, she may not be satisfied with that, but it's not in a harmful position. And even if you accept both of those points on face value, again, they don't get at the heart of the question in an impeachment inquiry, which is the motivations that drove the president to take this step. Is it an act of self-interest that did it, which as the Democrats argue? And that's what brings us all within the zone of potential impeachable conduct or part of a broader scheme that involves impeachable conduct. But the Republicans are trying to talk about any other issue but that in their defense.
All right. So I want to get your sense of how effective the Republican defense is here, because it seems to me that they have one objective and one objective only, which is to prevent the sort of erosion of the president's popular support that would cause the Republican unity to break, right? Because as long as they hold together, the president can be impeached, but he can't be removed. If you end up in a sinking ship situation, that's when, you know, rodents will scurry off the ship, right? And so as long as they keep ranks together, the presidency of Donald Trump gets maintained. And so is this set of defenses adequate to maintain Republican unity, which seems to me the not necessarily the moral standard to which one would want to hold the president, but it is the functional standard of success, right? Is can you defend him well enough so that Republicans can face their voters having voted to acquit him?
I think it's a hard question to answer because we are in such a unique and I think new media environment compared to similar types of proceedings in the past. Like, so for example, in the Yovanovitch hearing today, there was this exchange where Representative Stefanik you know, was specifically called upon by Devin Nunes to speak, even though under the rules under which this is proceeding, that's not allowed. And I viewed it as like a specific effort to create like a Fox News moment where you see Adam Schiff, you know, seeming to sort of shut down Representative Stefanik. And so it just seemed very deliberate. And so to the extent that Republicans can sort of create those types of moments that can then run on conservative media, that, you know, if the constituents are watching that media, that's what they're seeing. So you do see, I am seeing like a deliberate attempt to do that. On the other hand, it was also interesting to see that during the Yovanovitch testimony, when President Trump sort of tweeted the smear at her, you did see some of the members bristling on the Republicans, certainly on the Democratic side, but also on the Republican side, bristling a little bit and, you know, going out of their way to say, you know, we honor your service. And so it's interesting to see how the president is actually coming in and having an impact on what they're doing in real time in the hearing. So that could actually create complications for their strategy if the president is sort of, you know, sending a bomb in there that they then have to sort of clean up in the hearing. So I think it could be successful, again, only because of this sort of media environment that a lot of their constituents sort of are in.
All right. So one of the cool things about having a major State Department oriented scandal being Lawfare today is that we have not one but two former State Department lawyers in the office every day, and they are both right here in the Jungle Studio right now, Scott and Margaret, both of whom have experience with ambassadors and deputy assistant secretaries and the sort of people who are testifying today. This is, for many Americans, their first kind of significant exposure to the culture of the Foreign Service, the culture of the sort of diplomatic corps. It's certainly the first major scandal since Benghazi that is oriented around, you know, produces kind of public hearings, a kind of around culture and behavior at the State Department. We were talking on Rational Security yesterday about this as kind of a moment of real pride for a lot of Foreign Service officers. I'm curious, you know, this is a moment in which you have one ambassador and two, one of whom has ambassadorial rank, but two career Foreign Service officers all kind of testifying in 3 days and kind of like really making a statement about what the culture that they come from looks like. What was your reaction to it to sort of see the sort of career and you know, expertise side of the State Department kind of out front in this way over the last few days?
So I actually was really proud of the State Department. And what I saw was, you know, three people, again, who, as you say, have all this experience and expertise, really showing all of that expertise. I mean, you know, George Kent just has such a vast command of so much history about Ukraine and sort of everything that's gone on there. And he was really kind of showing he didn't really work from notes or anything. You know, he just sort of knows all of this stuff. And, you know, based on my experience at the State Department, that's the way Foreign Service officers are. They know their file. They have a command of whatever, you know, posts that they're doing. And they really are quite intelligent and, as a general matter, quite accomplished. So I felt pretty proud about it. I did feel that, you know, these three actually were in some ways the most stellar examples of the type of, you know, Foreign Service officer that I worked with and that I knew. So it was sort of like take your Foreign Service officer and, you know, put them on steroids. And that's what you have had this week from these witnesses from the State Department.
Scott, what did you think?
I'll agree with what Margaret said, but I also think it's worth really putting yourself in the position of these people and what it represents for them to be doing this. Testifying before Congress is most public servants' nightmare, and it's pretty much a nightmare for a lot of State Department employees, especially because State Department historically has had a little bit of a difficult relationship with a lot of people in Congress, particularly around funding issues, around authorities issues. And it's one of the more daunting tasks you can undertake. And here's a case with three people who are doing so really independent of the department, over objections by the department, although not post-subpoena necessarily, but not with the level of support or vetting or, you know, kind of preparation that you would do for a in-your-role sort of testimony. But they're still here speaking for the State Department and State Department's interests. And I think it's really telling, particularly if you when you look at Kent and Yovanovitch's opening statements. They spend a lot of time talking about not just their experiences and the facts, but really pointing out two things. One, that this is a case where private individuals with individual interests in an outcome were actively undermining U.S. national security and foreign policy interests. They say that explicitly. And that's a really pretty aggressive, straightforward criticism of the president and people around the president, more people around the president, but a really, really bold statement for somebody in that position. And to do so in your opening statement, meaning not in response to a question, you are anticipating that point and you are attacking it head on. The second point they spent a lot of time on is pushing back aggressively at some of the attacks they have seen taking place against their State Department peers and other peers in the interagency. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, Dr. Hill, other people who have been attacked because they are immigrants, attacked because they supposedly are impartial or never Trumpers. And they really took a target at that and said explicitly, particularly Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent, saying these people are patriots who have spent their careers advancing our interests. From my perspective, in both of these cases, really all three cases, you're seeing people who are kind of pushed to their limits. They're taking on a very uncomfortable position, but they're doing it because they think they're compelled to do so by a sense of duty, by a commitment to their peers, and frankly, because I think many of them feel, and Ambassador Yovanovitch was pretty explicit about this, that it's not just them that are under assault, it's the entire State Department, it's our entire diplomatic apparatus, and that the degree to which its administration has developed this adversarial relationship with it is going to undermine national security interests, possibly irreparably. And that is an underlying motivation and factor in a lot of what's happening in this impeachment testimony that I think resonates with a lot of State Department alumni and people in the department, and is part of the reason so many people see these figures as undertaking a pretty heroic task.
All right. So we're joined now by David Preece, Lawfare's chief operating officer, who also has written a book about the many ways of getting rid of presidents. And we are here only talking about one of them, since this is an impeachment proceeding. But David, I was interested in your sense of having watched the first couple days of this hearing or these hearings. To what extent is this similar to, and to what extent are the sort of allegations that we're thinking about now different from other situations in which we have, you know, come to have anxiety about the propriety of presidential conduct?
I've got three bins that I put my thoughts into on this. One is the overall impeachment itself. And on that, the interesting thing about this compared to previous impeachments is this is about core national security issues. The others were not. With Andrew Johnson, it was about the post-Civil War order and the cabinet appointments and the power thereof. With Bill Clinton, it was about perjury and obstruction of justice charges related to a personal matter. With Nixon on the margins, CIA was mentioned, but even in the drafting of the articles of impeachment, they did not move forward the article about Cambodia, and they focused more on the issues having to do with Watergate. So this is really the first time that we've had an impeachment that is about core national security issues of the withholding of foreign aid for partisan reasons, the seeking foreign assistance in a partisan political matter. The second bin is in the individual things that are happening now that either were not conceivable before because of technology or just didn't happen before. And the one that stood out was today in the testimony with Ambassador Yovanovitch, with the live tweeting of the president doing what Representative Schiff called witness tampering at the moment she was testifying. And that's different because I can't imagine Nixon and Clinton doing it, even if they had the technology in the way that it was done today. Andrew Johnson, mercurial, impulsive, maybe, but even during the impeachment hearings, he tempered his behavior somewhat. But this was a case where you could have, in real time, the president intimidating a witness. Now, why does that matter? Well, we heard Scott Anderson say that Foreign Service officers are not exactly eager to go in front of Congress and have this kind of testimony come out and be, in a sense, pushed to do this. I would say that goes plus 10 for intelligence community officers who have even less experience in those kinds of settings and much less experience talking in an unclassified way, which an open hearing by definition has to be. If there is another intelligence community whistleblower or even the first one, and there is someone else who wants to, in a sense, fortify their case, this is the kind of thing that keeps them from wanting to contribute. And that is stronger than in previous impeachments. The third and final bin is about the framing. What is the use of looking at the history unless it's going to inform the present? The Andrew Johnson impeachment was horribly framed, and it in fact led in many ways to his acquittal. The Bill Clinton framing, in fact, by being seen as a personal matter in and of itself, was framed in a way that did not lead to conviction. The Nixon framing was the best example that Adam Schiff and his colleagues have in terms of focusing on absolute core issues of abuse of power, obstruction of justice, contempt of Congress. And you could almost see Adam Schiff adding to a draft article of impeachment on the television screen when Donald Trump was live tweeting today, adding that to a potential article on contempt of Congress or obstruction of justice. The framing of this by keeping it to these core issues is going to be very important moving forward.
Yes, I really agree with that. I think in some ways the battle that we saw are seeing where Republicans are kind of test driving different modes of defense are all efforts at testing whether certain framings of the facts will stand up. And right, so from a Democratic point of view or from a pro-impeachment point of view, the framing that you want is the president essentially did what Nixon did in Watergate, right? Ginning up investigations, inappropriate spying on political enemies. Only instead of using Watergate burglars, he used a sovereign government whom he leaned on using instruments of state by way of doing it. That's kind of the framing that you want. So gross abuse of power, gross abuse of foreign policy. If you're a Republican defender of the president, the framing that you want is the president has a right to fire ambassadors. The president has a right to condition aid. The president was concerned about corruption. So you want to sort of reframe a series of things into kind of non-abusive, relatively routine exercises of unquestioned presidential powers. You want to make it seem like the crafting of that as impeachable is, in fact, itself the partisan exercise here. And so my question, David, is who is winning at this point the framing war?
Both sides have a huge advantage now, more so than in the past, which is they're speaking to their own bubbles in a way that the media segmentation is allowing them to do. So the short answer is both. I think both are succeeding in terms of feeding their constituencies what they want to hear. But there is one wild card here that gets in the way of those defending the president, and that is the president. When he tweeted out, "Everywhere Marie Yovanovitch went turned bad, she started off in Somalia. How did that go?"
Yeah, Canada's a mess these days. And it's all because Marie Yovanovitch served there.
When he puts that out there, throwing the grenade into the room, not only do you have a few seconds of some of the Republican members saying, often in the hallway outside when they were going to a vote, saying things like, "No, we actually support her. She's good." But in the afternoon session, you had Will Hurd, someone who the Republicans on the committee really want to keep on the reservation. You had him spend, what, probably a minute or two to start his limited questioning time listing all of the awards of Marie Yovanovitch. That is not the strategy for framing this that the president wanted, and he only has himself to blame because of that tweet. He drove those who could have helped him in that session to go off message and have to reinforce the credibility of this witness.
Margaret, when David said both were winning the framing war, I saw you grimace. Do you not think both are being effective in their framing?
No, I actually agree. I grimace because it's sort of just a sad state of affairs. And it kind of goes back to my earlier point about the media environment, that this is all being mediated through each side is seeing and hearing, you know, what they want to see and hear. And so the grimace more was like just kind of lamenting, you know, the loss of a period of time, at least the way I think of it, you know, during the Nixon hearings. You know, way my family members and people describe it to me is that like everybody was crowded around the television and everyone was watching the same proceedings and just seeing all the same things instead of what we have now, which is, you know, just sound bites coming from different media sources that reinforce, you know, what people's views already are. So I do think just like the media environment is making this a more difficult type of endeavor than maybe than in past impeachments.
I don't disagree with any of that, but I do think the Republicans are facing a real problem here. And that is, as David mentioned, the president. And not just the president, but a bifurcation between the president's White House and congressional Republicans. You see the president say, read the transcript. I want to talk about this phone call. I'm going to release the transcript and then I want to talk about it nonstop. It is the absolute last thing congressional Republicans want to talk about. They are desperately talking about anything but that phone call. Today, the president comes out in this tweet that David just read. And I think it's worth noting, this is not a tweet with weird punctuation, awkward spelling, out of syntax that you get when it's direct from the president. This is a well-composed, perfectly capitalized tweet of the sort that usually means it was prepared by White House staff. So this is a White House talking point. Came out and released this tweet. And instead, it's totally disjointed with what congressional Republicans want to do. There is, unlike with the Mueller report, where you had a very coordinated strategy for how the administration was going to respond that was coordinated pretty effectively, it seemed, with congressional Republicans and others, there's two strategies, or really multitude strategies, but with two different parties going on separate tracks. They're in a very friendly media environment, one that's going to try and knit these together. They've got a lot of different threads they can pull together. Some people are going to grasp onto different parts, but it's not a cohesive defense. And I do think that's something that's going to bite them in the end.
All right. So, David, we move from this week where we had three State Department officials to next week where we have a lot of people testifying next week, including if the schedule is for real, we're going to hear from Fiona Hill. We're going to hear from Gordon Sondland. We're going to hear from Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. So we're getting, first of all, we're going from the State Department into the White House. And even within the State Department, i.e. Sondland, we're dealing with now people who are directly talking to the president. So how does, like, all of a sudden, you know, this Republican defense this week, which was, you know, Ms. Yovanovitch, you've never met the president, right? Mr. Taylor, you know, Ambassador Taylor, you've never met the president. Everything's quite indirect, and we're sort of using the hearsay question as a way of putting distance between the president. That presumably goes away next week, right?
Part of my brain is telling me what a colossal mistake to focus this week on the issue of hearsay, hearsay, hearsay. Because next week it's going to be so obvious this is not hearsay, this is more direct evidence. And then the other part of my brain, the part that has evolved quickly in the last 2 years, kicks in and says, that probably doesn't matter because we're assuming that there is a logical sequence that people are going to need to follow to mount some defense of the president. And I think that the members of Congress on the Republican side will be perfectly happy to forget they ever focused on hearsay and just move on to some other charge against these witnesses. I doubt we will hear people attacking Vindman in the same way that we saw some in the media doing, because I think they tried that trial balloon and it popped relatively quickly. But I think they will move on and forget the fact that they ever focused on hearsay and move to something else. We will find that inconsistent, and I'm sure that there will be plenty of people analyzing this who point out the inconsistency. But will it matter to the constituency they're talking to? Okay, I don't think so.
So that's interesting. I mean, one of the things to have an impeachment is that you have to be able to itemize the things that the president did.
On the prosecution side, the impeachment, the pro-impeachment side.
Yeah. Right. I mean, if you're going to impeach the president, you need to be able to have some kind of a bill of particulars. And it does seem like the element of the hearsay objection, the element that I don't think it has merit, but it has a grain of truth to it, is that when you actually make a list of the things that we know specifically that Donald Trump did rather than that people did thinking it was what he wanted, I have no doubt truthfully, It's actually a pretty short list of things that we know that Trump himself did. And so my question is, as we get to next week, Scott, when you're trying to pin down like the interactions that the president is immediately part of, how big a premium is there on being able to identify, you know, specific actions that Donald Trump took, specific things that he said, specific directives that are known to have come from him as opposed to somebody surrounding him?
It depends on the audience, I think. Look, you don't need a strong – those direct connections to make a really compelling case that
these people
are doing something.
So not these people. You're not impeaching these people. You're impeaching Donald Trump, right? And so if you today had to write an article of impeachment, what are the things that you could say that Donald Trump did that we should impeach him for?
I mean, right now what we have is we have the July 25th phone call, which clearly fits into this overall scheme. We see the president directly raise the Bidens, directly raise the CrowdStrike investigations, pretty directly tie it, although some would contest this, but I think pretty directly tied to conditionality on security assistance slash the ability to purchase Javelin missiles and a White House meeting. We have a lot of credible testimony that this is the agenda that was being presented to the Ukrainians by people who were directly communicating with the president. And then we have some closed-door testimony, and we'll get more open testimony from Ambassador Sondland on Wednesday, who is going to be the center of the show.
And do you think – so I've been going back and forth about this with myself. Sondland is the person who has, assuming we never hear Mulvaney's testimony or Bolton's testimony, who has direct interactions with the president. So when he is now before – in an open hearing – and he's asked about direct communications with the president. Does he answer that or does he treat that as an executive privilege matter?
He has shown himself willing to answer it before. We know he testified in his closed-door testimony. I have – before he did that response to Bill Taylor saying no quid pro quo, he says, I talked to the president. And he gives a pretty detailed description of that conversation with the president where the president – from my reading, this is my reading, not Sondland's, read a little bit like he was panicking, saying, I don't want anything from the Ukrainians. I want them to do the right thing. No quid pro quo, no quid pro quo, no quid pro quo multiple times. That's a pretty honest depiction of this. If Sondland thought there was a line, he's already crossed it.
So you think he answers questions next week?
I think he's going to answer questions. He has throughout been a little evasive, a little minimalist, had very selective memory. I think we're going to see more of that. But that's why they're building this effort to pin him in. When they interview Bill Taylor, you saw the Democratic counsel go to Bill Taylor's notes and pick out specific quotes that he attributed to Sondland on the belief that Sondland had a link back to Trump. So they're going to focus on those specific quotes. They're going to focus on this new witness Taylor brought forward who overheard this phone call. And I suspect they're going to have that witness testify after Sondland. So Sondland knows there's still more opportunities for impeachment of him. And I think he's going to feel a lot of pressure from his personal reputation to avoid looking like he's being too evasive, although I doubt he's going to be as forthright as our witnesses thus far.
What do you think, Margaret? Is there – I mean, when you look at the next week, is the fundamental question bringing it home to the president, or is the fundamental task just fleshing out what was in those transcripts?
I think more the latter. I think more fleshing out what is in the transcripts because from my perspective, having read them all, there's so much in there and it is enough. I suspect with Gordon Sondland, you know, he will, I think, testify to what he's already testified to behind closed doors. I suspect he will not go that much further and will have a lot of trouble recalling a lot of things. So, you know, I'm not sure Sondland is going to be kind of like such a key witness just because I think he's really shown himself willing to just be like, don't recall. And I think we'll see a lot of that from him. So from my perspective, this is more about, you know, really kind of around the July 25th phone call, painting the picture around that whole phone call to really bring it to life. I would just also say, in addition to what Scott said about the phone call, he specifically in the call with Zelensky mentions Giuliani. And so bringing the whole Giuliani piece of this and what Giuliani was pushing, meaning the investigations, bringing all that to life is super important. And we already have the connection, in my view, through the phone call with the reference to Giuliani.
Yeah, let me add just one element to that. I think you're right, Margaret and Scott. I mean, on the transcript, it's there objectively. We've already got a nexus. But you don't have senators marching down Pennsylvania Avenue, Republicans, telling the president, Mr. President, we don't have the votes to support you. So I think there has to be something that tightens that nexus. If you think about even the Andrew Johnson impeachment, he publicly fired a cabinet official that he was barred from doing by law. You think about Richard Nixon, you could hear his voice obstructing justice. I think it has to get closer for those Republican senators to have that fig leaf that they can cover to their own constituency and say, we absolutely had to convict him.
And I think that going back to this Rudolph Giuliani point is a very important one. Rudolph Giuliani has not testified, very unlikely to testify here before this body. But he has made public statements on exactly this point and has said quite expressly, everything I did in the Ukraine, I did for the president. That is a pretty direct tie. So if you're tying these things back to Giuliani, it's hard for you to look at that statement and not say that this stuff goes back to the president and the president's interests. So I think that's going to be the fallback for Democrats. If they can't get Sondland to pin things directly to statements and directions directly from the president, I still think there's a chance they might. But if they aren't, then it becomes a Giuliani show and tying everything back to Giuliani. And it's hard to imagine Sondland finding another scapegoat other than the president except for Giuliani.
So one other possible scapegoat is Mick Mulvaney, because what we know about all these directives is that they came from the chief of staff slash OMB, which of course in this weird world that we live in is the same person. And so I could see the argument from Republicans that you would – if that the impeachment inquiry proponents would want to close off, which is that it's a Giuliani rogue operation or a Gordon Sondland rogue operation. But I can also see the argument that this is – Mick Mulvaney situation. And the problem is that the way to do that would be to fire Mick Mulvaney, which of course might encourage him to testify. And so, Margaret, what's your theory of the game theory of Mick Mulvaney? like if you're President Trump, are you being real nice to Mick Mulvaney?
How do you
Mulvaney
solve
right
a problem now? Like Mick Mulvaney?
Yeah, do you be nice to Mick Mulvaney? Do you terrorize him until he quits so you can blame him, but then maybe he'll testify? Like, what do you do?
It's a really good question. My best guess is that he'll keep him close and also terrorize him. So all of those things.
Wow.
Would
remind
be...
me not to get on your bad side.
That's the best play, I would think, is to keep Mulvaney close until this is sort of over and done with. I also would say, you know, Mulvaney doesn't look so great in any of this, too. So I'm not sure. I'm not convinced that, you know, Mick Mulvaney would be like, you know, ready to like run up to the hill and tell everything he knows, because I think he could get asked a lot of questions that wouldn't bear particularly well on himself.
All right. We're going to wrap up. We've already lost Susan and Quinta, for those who haven't noticed. And we've actually lost our special guest, the earth-moving equipment as well, which I can't imagine that any listeners are too upset about. But Scott, what are you looking forward to as the impeachment hearings head into their second week?
I think the things to look out for after Sondland, who I think is the star of the show next week, is to look at the testimony of Jennifer Williams and David Hale, because they're two actors. We don't have a strong sense of what they're testifying to, nor have we seen their closed door transcripts yet, which is a point of a little bit more legitimate complaint on perhaps on the part of some, although some Republicans were obviously in the closed door sessions. And so I'm very curious what they're going to testify. Jennifer Williams is in the vice president's office, believed to be on the July 25th call, probably going to testify to the contents of the call. I believe she's testifying with Tim Morrison of the NSC. But we'll have to see. This is really the question of how much did Pence know and was his involvement that she's going to be asked to bring out. As to David Hale, who is a very senior official in the State Department, I'm not aware of him having a direct role in this. You know, certainly seemed to, would likely to have a role in the potential removal of Ambassador Yovanovitch, perhaps in the appointment of Bill Taylor. So perhaps there's some other aspect of this story around that personnel shift that we haven't seen fully fleshed out yet that he plays a central role in. But I think both of their appearances are very interesting, and I'm curious to see what they say.
David, what's your eyes on in week two?
I am fascinated by the momentum here. Clearly, a lesson was learned by Pelosi, by Schiff, by Nadler, by all of them from the Mueller report rollout. They learned if you don't have momentum and create the illusion of more momentum, you lose it. What's happened with these hearings? They've moved quickly. They've had the closed-door hearings. They've systematically released the testimony, almost all of which had some moments that we said, oh, so that's what was said. Even in the open testimony, after the release of the closed-door transcripts, we still had on Wednesday a surprise in the morning. Today, we still had a surprise, admittedly, of the president's doing. But I think that ability to build momentum by having some new surprise each day or two will be absolutely crucial.
Margaret, Scott is looking at surprise witnesses. David's looking at momentum. What are you looking at?
I'm looking right at Fiona Hill because she
is Brookings colleague.
That's right. She will be, it would seem, at least at this point, based on the schedule, their sort of cleanup batter for all of this. And based on my read of her deposition transcript, I can absolutely see why, because she is a firecracker. And you can just, it comes through in the pages of the deposition transcript. And she just seems very confident, very effective, very strong views, very committed as a public servant, and also a Trump appointee. So I'm most looking forward to seeing how she sort of presents her views at the end of this, at least the end for now, as we see the schedule before us.
Yeah, I will say I do not expect Fiona Hill to pull punches, not in an inappropriate way, but she is she's a very careful scholar, but she is also a real no bullshit person, and I think the tone of her deposition transcript reflects, I suspect, the tone that she will take in public. I mean, she gave that deposition knowing full well that it would become public. And so I agree with you. The sort of somewhat feisty tone of it is likely to reflect some sparkly fireworks of a hearing. Okay, we're going to leave it there. Margaret Taylor, Scott Anderson, David Preece, and Quinta Jurassic and Susan Hennessy joining us remotely, and our good friend, the Earth Moving Equipment outside. Thank you all for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with, you guessed it, the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the whole Lawfare crew for reading thousands of pages of transcripts, watching many hours of hearing, and just coming into the Jungle Studio to chew it all over. Our music is, as always, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell, who made a specific request of me to say to you guys that you are not doing your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast, tweeting enough about the Lawfare Podcast. How many of you have tweeted an episode of the Lawfare Podcast recently? And if you're not one of the ones who raised your hand just then, I want you to stop and tweet about the Lawfare Podcast right now. I want you to go to thelawfarestore.com and buy Lawfare swag. And I want you to, you guessed it, leave us a rating on whatever podcast distribution service you found us on. I'm Benjamin Wittes, and as always, thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.